This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
But that really kind of underscores the fundamental dynamic that I see throughout all of these stories and across all of these states is, you know, kind of an individualism versus a knowledge of the greater good. And there is a sense among everybody that I talk to that the greater good could be achieved through a bit more cooperation.
Discussions about the West's epic drought tend to focus on the need to cut back on residential and agricultural water usage. The importance of water conservation during this record dry spell notwithstanding, sound water management turns out to be a lot more than just water use. Today on Sea Change Radio, I speak with Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica, who's writing a multi-part series exposing unfortunate policies and practices vis-a-vis our most precious, life-sustaining resource. We learn about an enormous power plant on Native American land in Arizona, which helped create the modern desert cities of Phoenix and Tucson, explore some of the antiquated water policies for landholders in the American West, and discuss the conundrum of water management and long-term growth facing desert metropolises like Las Vegas. Then we hear an excerpt of my interview with filmmaker James Redford from a few years ago as he explains the vast importance of the Colorado River to the West's water supply. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Abram Lustgarten. He's an environmental reporter for ProPublica. Abram, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So you've been doing some terrific work for ProPublica recently. A lot of times we hear about water being used in inefficient ways, but your work has really taken it to a new level. Why don't you give us an overview of the different ways you've approached kind of exposing the inefficient use of water in the West?
Sure. So, you know, the Colorado River Basin is probably the single most important source of water for the western United States. Even California, which is focused on its own drought, relies on the Colorado River for some 16% of its surface water and uses about a third of the Colorado River. And as the whole western half of the United States has been beleaguered by drought and climate change, we've been producing a series of stories, a series of investigations essentially into how human management, policies, government oversight, government regulations, and incentives have to one degree or another caused the water crisis. And the point being that there is plenty of water in the West. The water crisis as it's being experienced is not necessarily, the West is not victimized by climate change or by the environment alone. We've done this to ourselves. And so we're looking at ways in which that's happened, which leads to ways in which it might be able to be changed. And for example, we're looking at federal subsidies and incentives to grow inefficient crops like cotton. The vast amounts of energy that are used to move water around the West, which cause climate pollution, which then, you know, kind of cyclically exacerbate climate change, which leads to less water, et cetera. Incentives in the water laws itself, a story about what they call use it or lose it that encourages farmers to basically waste water when it's needed most simply because the laws haven't been updated in more than 100 years. And of course, the great demand of water and growing demand of water by the cities in the West. We focused on Las Vegas in particular and one water manager's decision making there. And an attitude of essentially always being able to find more, no matter what kind of water environmental constraints the city was up against.
Well, let's dive into that one first. Las Vegas is a desert, and anybody who's gone there may be pretty shocked by the amount of water that's being used in the middle of a desert. There's golf courses and the water show at the Bellagio Hotel. It's just a stark contrast to the reality of water in this epic drought that we have. But we've also heard some very progressive stuff coming out of Las Vegas in terms of their water management tools over the last decade plus. What is your take on it?
Well, that's exactly the irony and conflict that interested me in Las Vegas. And we looked at Las Vegas as an example of the pressures that cities across the West are all facing in terms of their need to grow and their need to find more water. Las Vegas is similar in that regard to Phoenix and Los Angeles and Denver and San Diego and so forth. But our story about Las Vegas focused on a woman named Pat Mulroy. And for a very long time, she was the head of Las Vegas's chief water agencies. And she made most of the decisions about how the city would plan for its future water use and where it would get that water. And at the same time, she's really quite a visionary water manager. Of all the people I've met in more than a year of reporting, she is probably the wisest and most informed about the water constraints facing the West, and really has the keenest understanding of what kind of limits the West is up against. And so you're right. She has, through many years of necessity, she has figured out how to make Las Vegas more efficient in many ways, reduce residential use, recycle a portion of Las Vegas's water, and lots of great things that have allowed that city to grow. Behind all of that, however, has been this steady rate of growth. And in many, many conversations with Pat Mulroy, I was repeatedly struck by an attitude which essentially said that every kind of solution to the water crisis should be on the table. We can come up with new technologies. We're going to seed clouds. We're going to build pipelines. We're going to make houses more efficient and so forth. But the only thing that's absolutely off the table that should not be discussed in the West is growth itself, is somehow limiting or slowing down the economic expansion that ultimately leads to a greater demand for water. And that, to me, stands as a fundamental contradiction and one of the greatest problems in the West's general approach to water. For all the great things that Las Vegas has done and that Pat Mulroy has done, the bottom line is that over the three decades that she was there, the city's draw of water out of the Colorado River has expanded enormously. It's not the biggest user of Colorado River water. It's not solely responsible or even largely responsible for the decline in Lake Mead, but its water use has grown steadily and it will continue to grow. And the city does not right now have future supplies that will match its future needs. And it's very clear about that.
Yes, you quote Rob Marocca, who's a scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, and he says, the specter of rapid growth was like a mermaid sitting on a rock, calling. So it is a slippery slope, so to speak, for politicians who want to be able to claim jobs and all the other economic barometers that we attach to being a successful politician. But the long-term view of actually trying to cut back in these places that are resource limited, we all are, but in such a stark way, like Las Vegas and water, it's a very difficult labyrinth for a politician to navigate, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what this comes down to in its simplest form is short-term gratification over, you know, a bit more long-term prudence. And that's what we found in Las Vegas is that Pat Mulroy and others knew better. They understood the problems. They had a quite keen grasp on them. And yet the short-term temptations, the year-to-year economic growth, the pressures from the building industry, the large home builders, the big casino owners, the political contributions that affect the city council members who ultimately vote on zoning changes for new developments that require new water, all of those things, like the quote that you cited says, proved irresistible politically and financially.
And she says, we live in a free country where people can move wherever they want. I can build a desalter. I can cause more conservation. I can't slow growth and manage growth. But how could she slow growth and manage growth? How would somebody on the other side of that dialogue perhaps approach it?
Well, you could raise water rates, for one, to a point where they incentivized conservation and essentially limited water use so that people simply could not afford to use extraordinary amounts of water. You could apply different water rates to businesses or casinos than you might for residential use. I mean, that's just one of a number of approaches.
And it's probably fair to look at Las Vegas through a different lens than we would in a normal urban area. We're not talking about pricing water so high that people would never move there. We're talking about trying to limit these very elaborate displays of opulence that are in the middle of an area which should not be displaying that kind of opulence when it comes to something like water. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. This isn't unique to Las Vegas. Even as Las Vegas actually has improved its residential landscaping, for example, but across the West, whether you're talking about Denver or Los Angeles, it's people's lawns that use up an extraordinary amount of water. And while lawns are can be visually appealing and are a nice thing to have, they're far from a necessity. And when you look at the scope of the crisis and its importance for the U.S. economy, for our way of life in the West and in all of the Western states, and you ask whether lawns is what you want to sacrifice all that for, I think most people, would say no. And again, that's just one of a long list of opportunities to change our behavior and change our water supply.
I'm going down someday. My nose is in the sand. I'm going down, 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 babe. My nose is in the sand. Cloud of dust have came over me. I think I'm drowning on dry land.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Abram Lustgarten. He's an environmental reporter for ProPublica. So, Abram, you write about one of the more infuriating situations in the most recent installment of your chronicling this water crisis in the West. It's entitled The End of the Miracle Machines, Inside the Power Plant Fueling America's Drought. Tell us about this Navajo Generating Station. It is an amazing marvel in some ways, but also horrifying in others.
Yeah, the Navajo Generating Station is the West's largest coal-fired power plant. It came online in 1976. The last of its three generators was completed. It was, in that era, an engineering marvel. It was one of the largest coal-fired power plants ever built. As such, today, it's one of the nation's most significant greenhouse gas polluters. It's the third largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the United States.
But it does something very specific.
The Navajo Generating Station was essentially built to move water into central Arizona. There's a companion project called the Central Arizona Project. It's a 336-mile-long canal built by the federal government to shuttle water from the Colorado River to the cities of Phoenix and then south to the cities of Tucson. Because Tucson is significantly higher, about 2,800 feet higher than the Colorado River, that water has to be moved uphill. The pumps that move that extraordinary amount of water uphill use an enormous amount of energy, and the Navajo power plant supplies that energy.
So give us an idea of the amount of water and how far it has to go.
Okay, so the Central Arizona Project moves about 10% of the flow of the Colorado River, about 2 million acre feet of water. That's the measure that they use. It moves it up over about an 800-foot set of mountains and then into a canal, and that canal moves a couple hundred miles across the desert to Phoenix and then another hundred or so more south to Tucson. It is spread in between across agricultural lands to grow crops from cotton to corn to alfalfa, and it's one of the most significant factors in Arizona's economic expansion, in the urban expansion of those two cities in particular. As of 2010, a study by the state of Arizona attributed the Central Arizona Project and the water that it brought gave that project credit for about half of the state's gross domestic product.
And it also accounts for 29% of Arizona's emissions from energy generation, this Navajo station alone.
It does. It's just huge. I think the power plant is or the canal is the single largest user of energy in the state of Arizona.
And without this plant, what would the cities of Phoenix and Tucson do?
Well, if the plant had never existed, the cities of Phoenix and Tucson might have grown differently than they did. They might have grown in a more sustainable fashion or with more efficient water systems or culturally having taken a different approach to residential water use. But that's, under the bridge, so to speak. If the plant were to go away today, which is something that's been, a conversation for many years now as the EPA has tried to control emissions from the plant, the Central Arizona Project would have to go and source the energy that they need to move that water elsewhere. So they could do that through renewable energy. They could do that through natural gas-fired power plants. There are other options. There is power available for purchase, the managers of the Central Arizona Project tell me. So for roughly the same cost and with far fewer emissions, they would be able to move that same water. There's other complicated financial arrangements that they have with the Navajo Generating Plant, which give them an incentive to keep burning coal to do it.
And how has the drought affected the conversations surrounding the future of the Navajo plant?
Well, ironically, it really hasn't. And that's one of the things that struck me as most significant. You know, as the nation's third largest emitter of greenhouse gas pollution, the Navajo Generating Plant arguably plays a role in the climate change that we're experiencing, the climate change that is widely attributed as a reason for the water scarcity in the Colorado River Basin. That's essentially causing or contributing to the drought. And yet we continue to burn more coal and emit more of that pollution for the sake of moving that water, which requires more effort and more energy the more scarce that water gets. So there's a bit of an ironic self-perpetuating cycle that has not really been addressed by policymakers in Arizona or the federal government.
And one of the policies that's being considered is taking down the Glen Canyon Dam to hold back Lake Powell. Could you explain how that might solve this problem?
Well, our story looked at the Navajo Generating Plant as one example of the enormous infrastructure that's been built up and down the Colorado River. The river has essentially been turned into a huge plumbing system. There's very little about its flow that's still natural. And more than 100 dams, many canals, tunnels that route it back eastward underneath the Continental Divide, into the eastern range of front range of Colorado. So the Glen Canyon Dam is another one of those pieces of infrastructure. It's the nation's second largest reservoir behind it, Lake Powell, and it is the dam that holds essentially the northern Colorado River state's supply of water. The problem with Lake Powell is not only that it's a little bit less than half full, like Lake Mead, it's simply there isn't enough water to fill it. But scientists estimate that Lake Powell loses an enormous amount of water, that it essentially seeps into fissures in the rock underneath the reservoir. It's not a watertight basin. And at the same time, these huge reservoirs in the very hot desert climate also lose an enormous amount of water to evaporation. So with Lake Powell and the Glen Canyon Dam, what you have is an enormous piece of infrastructure that loses between seepage and evaporation about 6% of the entire flow of the Colorado River just by holding that water still, but is only half full and has at times has been less than half full. And essentially it seems to be passing its moment of usefulness.
Tell me, what you gonna do when your well runs dry? What you gonna do when your well runs dry? What you gonna do when your well runs dry? I'd like to know what you gonna do when your well runs dry.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Abram Lustgarten. He's an environmental reporter for ProPublica. people should definitely go read his work at ProPublica.org. We'll link to it on SeaChange Radio as well. The use it or lose it laws. Can you explain what those are and how their impact is so vital in the current drought situation that we find ourselves in the West?
Sure. All of the Western states share a body of what they call water law. And it's based in part on a philosophy that's called first in time, first in right. It's the law of prior appropriation. And what it essentially means is that the first people who showed up out west and claimed use to that water were given senior rights, and the people who came after them were given more junior rights. And the right to take water is kind of guaranteed as a property right and is prioritized based on that order of who showed up first. One of the key factors in prior appropriation law, which is something that's that goes back 100 years or so in each of the various states that follow this doctrine, is this idea that those water rights could be taken away if they are not fully utilized. It's a law that began with the best of intentions, but we looked at its effect today. And so today in Colorado, in the western slope of Colorado, you have a number of farmers and ranchers who do not need the same amount of water that they did 100 years ago to farm their properties. For various reasons, their crops have become more efficient, or the crops they grow have changed, or the water delivery systems are slightly different. But their water is an extraordinary part of the value of their property. It is an asset that is tied to their wealth. And because the state law has never been changed, because it still gives the state engineer of Colorado the right to confiscate water rights if they're not fully utilized, farmers basically divert the maximum amount of water they're allowed to, and they spill it over their fields, whether they need it or not, so that they can do what they call proving up their water rights. So the big picture is that across the West, not just in Colorado, but each of these states has a law similar to this. The law incentivizes every individual water user to use as much as they possibly can, at the same time that policymakers are out trying to urge people to be more conservation oriented, to be more efficient in their water use, and essentially save some for later. Now, the kicker to me is that when I talk to all of these farmers who describe this this situation, they'll readily say that if the law allowed them to save their water, to not use it 1 year but take some back the next year or something like that, if their water rights were protected, they would happily and easily use less. And that's something that could happen almost overnight.
It is really head-scratching. And you quote this one farmer who says, "It's like I've got a devil and an angel on my shoulder. On the one hand, the Colorado River flowed all the way into the Sea of Cortez this year. It brings a tear to my eye. On the other, we give them our water, and what do we get in return?"
But that really kind of underscores the fundamental dynamic that I see throughout all of these stories and across all of these states is, you know, kind of an individualism versus a knowledge of the greater good. And there is a sense among everybody that I talk to that the greater good could be achieved through a bit more cooperation, whether it's interstate cooperation or inter-citizen cooperation that can essentially solve or help solve the water crisis in the West. But the various incentives, and in this case, it's this old use it or lose it law, essentially requires that individual water users have to look out for themselves first. And I think that's something that we can all identify with. No one wants to sacrifice their personal wealth, their family's wealth, their ability to send their kids to college because they thought it would be a nice thing to send a little bit more water down to Arizona. And as long as the laws continue to incentivize people to think that way, we're really in a bind.
Abram Lustgarten, you do some terrific work for ProPublica. These are very complicated but very important issues that you are able to explain clearly, and I can't recommend enough our listeners to go and read your work. Abram, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on.
SeaChange Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu. This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio.
Now let's listen to a little excerpt from my 2012 discussion with Jamie Redford. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by James Redford. He's the producer of the documentary film Watershed. Jamie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Walk us through first some of the A to Z of the actual Colorado River and what it would naturally look like and what it looks like today.
Sure. Well, the Continental Divide that runs down through the spine of the Rocky Mountains, water that goes to the east heads towards the Missouri and the Mississippi and ends up either down out through Texas or the into the Gulf of Mexico. And that's the watershed that heads east. The watershed that heads west, the Colorado River is starting in the headwaters are on the backside of the Front Range in Colorado, in communities like Steamboat, Granby, Grand Lake. That water flows westward down through western Colorado, joins with a number of rivers as it goes, the Yampa, the White, the Green.
Which form the Grand Canyon, essentially, yes. Right?
That's right. And it heads south all the way down and ultimately, ended up down in the Colorado River Delta, which is basically the northern end of the Baja Peninsula. And the water would empty out into that peninsula and was at one time one of the most important migratory bird flyover spots in North America and home to a local shrimp economy for the local Native Americans, as well as trade routes. As little as 50, 60 years ago, these things were still in place. Today, if you go down there, it's a desert. Today, the waters that come down to the west of the Continental Divide, before they even reach a place like Glenwood Springs near Aspen, almost half the water has been diverted to head over, pumped over the Front Range to the residents of Denver and the various communities up and down the Front Range. And as our fly fisherman character says in the movie, you got to wonder sometimes when you see millions of acres of green lawns all through the, maybe not millions. When you see, the vast, vast amount of green lawns along the Front Range, and you think, wow, they're willing to destroy a beautiful natural scenery up here in order to create an artificial one down there. That's a fundamental problem right off the start, you take someone like John Wesley Powell, who on the one, a great explorer, one-armed Civil War veteran who threw together nine men to go down the river with him and explore it in a wooden rowboat, managed to survive a harrowing trip down the river. This was a man that went on to be a believer in water reclamation. So in some ways, people have varying opinions about how he saw water could be used. But one thing for certain, he really understood that people that lived in the West were not going to be able to replicate the environment that they came from back east. We were not going to be able to move west and have Kentucky bluegrass and agriculture that resembled our roots back on the East Coast. And he said, unless we learn to inhabit the Western arid area on its own terms, we're going to end up with problems. And that is something that he said in 1880.
This was before golf really took off.
Yeah, exactly. And boy, was he right.
Please check out the Sea Change Radio archives to listen to my interview with James Redford in its entirety. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stanton Moore, Albert King, and Peter Tosh. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.